Also, speaking of choirs, we have a special note from some friends who are, they're fairly far away, which were a part of us, in fact, in this building for a good 20 years. And we've got a message from them. Today. I knew there were four blasts on the trumpet, and of course that was Paula Hoover. No, that was David Hoover, and they both David and Paula, who we do miss. A lot of us have been in communication with them, and we do miss them. But they're happy in their new home in Northern California. But it was really funny, to be honest with you. There's a story behind the story. I called David and I said, "Hey, do you mind if we get a little excerpt of the shofar?" And he said, "Yeah, you know." And four or five jokes later, then Sabbath, Manfred comes up to me. Well, I was a Manfred, and Manfred says, "Hey, would it be okay if we played the shofar from David Hoover? I've got an old recording of it." And I said, "You're not going to believe it. I've got a recording as well." So I thought that was kind of nice. Today, as you've heard repeatedly, and it bears repeating again, today is a very important day, as we've heard in the previous messages. But as you heard in one of the messages, and my son and I did not share notes. In fact, he wouldn't tell me what he was going to speak on. Nice kid. Anyway, it's interesting, we both came to the same conclusion. When we look at the text, as he did in Leviticus, in the Torah, in the law, I want you to put your thinking caps on a little bit. Indeed, the spring holidays and unleavened bread we have, historically, we have it tied to the feast of unleavened bread at Exodus of Egypt. It's a historical event. Pentecost, we'd say mathematically, could be the giving of the law at Sinai. And I studied some of the, it's easy to do, I Googled it, and I have a couple of references. On atonement, it's the cleansing of the wilderness temple and the two goats. When we come to the Feast of Tabernacles, it is the wandering and the temporary dwellings, which many of these days we will picture. But trumpets is kind of left out. Trumpets really doesn't have a historical context. And I know there's lots of speculation, but they're no more than that. They're speculation. Every source book I looked at said there is no Old Testament typology to trumpets. Nehemiah Gordon, which many of you are familiar with, he's a Jewish scholar, Karaite Jew, has stated this as others did. One of the unique things about the Yom Teruah, as we heard from Mr. Weber and from John in the first message, Yom Teruah, the day of shout, is that the Torah does not say what the purpose of this holy day is. The Torah gives us at least one reason for all the other holy days, and often two reasons for some. In contrast to all these Torah festivals, Yom Teruah has no clear purpose other than that we are commanded to rest on this day. Now, there's many traditions that the Jews have, and they're fine, and they're interesting, but they're just that. They're traditions, and they're not text-based. But we do know the trumpets in Yom Teruah is literally a day of alarm and warning. That's what happens when we call them alarms. They're to get our attention. And again, we can speculate absolutely endlessly. And the Church of God is well known for that speculation. But it is a mystery in the Old Testament. But as we heard earlier, and as I hope to show today, we do know now. Turn with me, if you would, in the New Testament, because it does have, again, as we've heard, a very exact and very large and broad meaning. Turn with me, if you would, to Matthew chapter 24. It's usually not a verse or section that we go to on the Day of Trumpets, but I think it has great import for this day. Now, it's important when we review the days, and we review this particular section, as I hope you'll agree with me when we're done, that they're part of our understanding. But I want to focus on a specific aspect. We're familiar with these verses. I want to discuss with you today the sign of the end of the age, why we celebrate and remember this day among all the others that you've heard today. How are we to view, possibly emphasize, our world in the light of this particular day? The questions that we'll try and answer are the when and the what of this day. All churches, all denominations have, that believe in the New Testament, have a theology around Matthew 24, which is also known as the Olivet Prophecy. It's known as the Olivet Prophecy, as we'll read, because that is where it occurred, and also, interestingly enough, where Jesus one day would return. The temple is in view, so let's begin. Verse 1, then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to show him the buildings of the temple. Now, it's not clear whether he was in the temple at the time, but they moved away from it. And Jesus said to them, do you not see all these things? And just imagine, how many of you have been, I have not, but I've seen pictures. How many of you have been to Temple Mount? Or been, quite a few of you have. And I looked at a number of views, and it's very clear to see from the Mount of Olives the entire Temple Mount and the structures that would have been on it at the time. So I want you in your mind's eye, as we read through this, to picture it as Jesus and the disciples did. He's looking back at the temples. One of the other Gospels tells us that the disciples showed them how great and wonderful these buildings were. Jesus says, do you not see all these things? Surely I say to you, not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. Now, he's just been told how wonderful these buildings are. He responds, they're all coming down. Now, that would get my attention, as I'm sure it would you. If someone told you a skyline of Los Angeles and said, by the way, they're coming down, that would cause you to sit bolt upright. It would also cause you to ask questions. This is critical to understanding what follows, which is some 100 verses. And if you have a red letter Bible, they're almost all, except for one particular inset, they're all in red. It is one of the most continuous sets of dialogue in the entire New Testament, other than probably the Sermon on the Mount. Now, we're not going to read all approximately 100 verses, I promise, but it is important. So in verse 3, now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us. Now watch what they ask him. Tell us when these things shall be, and what will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age? They ask two questions, very simple questions. A when? When will this all happen? And for some interesting reason, they connect the destruction of the temple to Christ's return. It says, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world? When is it going to happen? And what will be the sign? Now, it's interesting, when we ask those two questions, the when and the what, it's about man's need to know. Now, last time I talked to you, we discussed this desire, this obsession that man has to know. We have got to know. That little thing that you were asked to turn off or turn down before services, that phone that we cannot live with, that sits within 2 to 3 feet of us almost 24/7. I know. I got one too. But now we have to know, and our phones tell us. In fact, we've got two verbs. Wiki it. Do you know what wiki it means? What's it mean? Wikipedia. The source of all knowledge. Right? The source of the collective source of all man's knowledge. And the other verb is Google it. Google and Wikipedia work up what's called an algorithm. And an algorithm is a word we've all heard it in the news. And I want to give you a definition. So when I wanted a definition of algorithm, guess what I did? What? I Googled it. What did you expect me to do? An algorithm is a process or set of rules to be followed in calculations or other problem-solving operations, especially but not exclusively by a computer. It could have very, very few steps, or it can have many, many, many steps. And there's a whole science about it. It's like a recipe of numbers and a series of commands. Pick any word, and you can Google it. And when I did Google the word algorithm, I received, and it tells me this, 297 million results, Oh, and by the way, Google tells you, they did it in 0.58 seconds, just so you know how quick we are. It's important. These search engines, and the church uses search engines on our own website, is to know. It may not be correct on Wikipedia, but hey, close enough. Close enough. But we have to have an answer. And prophecies are no different. In fact, it sounds like a lot of the prophecies we've heard throughout our lifetime. Not quite accurate, not quite approximate, but they come nonetheless. Let's read on. Jesus answered to these two questions, the what and the when. Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed. Take heed that no one deceive you, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are all not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famine and pestilence and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows." Jesus answers and says there will be false messiahs. There will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes. And you've read this many, many times. After reading that, famines, pestilences, false prophets, check, 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 check. We have those now. We have all that right now. There is not a year that does not go by that these issues arise. Everything that has been brought up in Matthew 24 in these four short verses. The issue is we are instantly aware of them. The problem is it's normal and it's expected for us to know, and it's constant. Flash news. North Korea has just fired 2 missiles over Japan. Wait. News flash. Another Hollywood star has taken their life. Stop. Wait. News flash. And the South Sudan famine threatens 20 million people. All of that occurred last year in 2017. All of it has already occurred in 2018 numerous times. With a few religious zealots thrown in. What's the world's response at news like that? Well, what's on PBS tonight? After the earthquakes, the famines, the wars and rumors of wars, he mentions uses the word deceive. He says, don't be deceived. I think we've gone beyond deceived. The world has, at least. We've become desensitized. It means nothing to us. Absolutely, seemingly nothing. Last Sabbath, I did have my phone muted. It wasn't off, and I had to do the announcements. So as I got up to do announcements, my phone, all the sound was down, it began to shake dramatically. Calm down, shake again. What is going on? I was getting these news alerts, and it kept coming and coming. And I walked off. I said, it can wait. Everybody's still around. I look, Becky's still here, so the first resurrection has occurred. I'm good. So far, so good. Right? Everybody's still here. All right, I'll go up. Guess what the text alerts were for? All 8 of them. The U.S. Tennis Open had finalized, and there was an upset. That was the news we needed to know. And it kept coming. This is not deception. It's desensitization. It's worse than being deceived. It's apathy. The world has been drugged into so what? And this is a danger. You'll notice that in all of these wars and rumors of wars and famines, there are absolutely no specifics. No nations are mentioned. No areas, no races, no religions are mentioned. It's vague at best, but it will be different. But why is he so vague? Why doesn't he name names, name people? I think there's a reason, and we're going to talk about that reason. It's not a puzzle or secret knowledge that he's keeping from us. It will happen, and it will happen dramatically. He doesn't give specifics, but in verse 8, he says something very important. He said, oh yeah, the worst is yet to come. This, he says, is just the beginning. But in verse 6, and you heard this in the first message when Mr. Weber brought it up, let's read verse 6 again. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, because these things have to come to pass. They have to happen before the end comes. But he says, you are not to be troubled. Don't be afraid. We have one of the most beautiful songs in our hymnal, Be Not Afraid. I think you'll remember it. It's a beautiful melody. He says to be not afraid or troubled. Why? Do these verses, when you hear them, and many of you have heard them for many, many years, do they trouble you? False Christs, rumors of wars, earthquakes, famines, they should scare you to death. How many of you have ever been in an earthquake? Yeah, that's right. I forgot where we were. That's fun, isn't it? I've lived here most of my life. Every earthquake is an earthquake. They should scare us. They're meant to. That's one of the reasons Jesus brings them up. They are meant to trouble, but he said, be not afraid. But it is normal. The Greek is interesting here. It means emotionally distraught. Well, when these things happen in rapid succession, and as we'll see when it gets closer to home, you will be distraught. And it's something that should not be dismissed. Let's keep going. In these next verses, Jesus increases his focus and becomes a little bit more personal. He starts to target a little bit more. And you'll see this, a successive refocusing, change, refocusing, and gets very, very specific. Verse 9, then they will deliver you up. The you happens three times in one verse. They will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. And you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended and betray one another and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will arise and deceive many. There's that word again. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. You means you. There will be things, Jesus says, that will happen to you. They are undefined, except in these vaguest of terms. Who's the they here? They will do these things. He doesn't say. He doesn't elaborate. And there's a reason. Too much of a good thing can also be a bad thing. Too much knowledge makes us apathetic. We know all that. But he doesn't mention anything here. He doesn't tell us. He also says, even though we'll be delivered up and hated and killed, we could spend hours discussing this. I think it's futile. It's utterly futile because verse 14 is so important. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached into all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. So once the gospel is preached unto all the world, now if ever there was a more pregnant verse to the church of God, that be the one. Let's analyze it at about a 40,000 foot level. The gospel is a very simple cognate of two Greek words, euangelion. EU is when you do a eulogy, it means good. We do good words at someone's passing. Would you participate in the eulogy? Good words. So we have the word you. We have the word angelion, where we get the word angel or message. It means a good message. Not messenger, but good message. It's good news. So does it mean good news? Yes. Does it mean good message? Yes. It's something good that's being preached. It's that simple. What does it mean? We believe it means the good news of the kingdom of God, brought about and by whom? The words of the person we are reading, Jesus Christ. It is not a simple phrase. It has deep, deep meaning. But whatever this is, and whatever Jesus Christ means here, he is saying that with all this chaos, all this upheaval, all this fear of the world, and possibly to a small degree, hopefully, God's people, the gospel somehow, some way, will be preached. Somehow. Again, Jesus does not elaborate. He does not say what the mechanism is. And again, we can speculate. And that would be utterly and completely fruitless. But somehow, some way, even as the special music, if you heard the lyrics, which we tried very, very hard to enunciate, because they are very powerful, the special music very clearly said, God will get it done. Some way, somehow, God will get it done. And that comes from trusting Him. If God isn't going to do it, it won't get done. Through all what we have read these verses, the world is coming apart at its seams. And those of us that understand what it may mean, it still will come as a shock. It's meant to be. It'll never happen again like this. But somehow God proclaims His gospel because it belongs to Him and we trust Him. I think we will be utterly, I pray that I'm there to see it. We will be utterly amazed at what God has planned on the way in the methodology that He is going to proclaim His gospel. I trust Him. I know you do too. I trust His Son. I know you do. In the next few verses, Jesus intensifies it. He becomes very, in some cases, specific. He names places. He names places. And to a lesser degree, He names names. And He even talks about some extremely exacting personal situations. So you can see this narrowing of concept and focus. So, let's read. Therefore, verse 15, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight not be on the Sabbath or winter, in the winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be a great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time. Nor shall there ever be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be thankfully shortened. There's a lot here. He names a place. He finally, after 15 verses, has started to begin to answer the question that was put to him in verse 3. Finally, the prophecy of Daniel, as you may know, deals with the temple precinct and the altars, and they're desecrated by a desecrator. Now remember, the disciples are asking questions. He may be pointing to the temple. He says, when you see the abomination of desolation, I can see that, he can just point at it. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, no. What's interesting is about the book of Matthew is that we think there was a partial fulfillment of this prophecy of the desolation in 165 BC with Antiochus. And again in 70 AD, partially, with Titus in the Roman legions. If Matthew was compiled late in the first century, both these events would have been known to the reader. They both would have been known, both Titus and Antiochus, and they would have been partial but extremely devastating occurrences. The temple was near destroyed, but not totally, in both those times. So when is it? When is it? Well, it's got to be about this time of year. I think it's coming. How many of you have heard about the red heifer? Oh, quite a few of you. Oh, the red heifer. I'm not trying to make... Yes, I am. The red heifer and its sacrifice is essential to the construction, the purification of the third temple in Jerusalem, which ushers in the Messiah's return and judgment. And I know it's happening because on September 4th, the New York Post, how many of you know about the New York Post? Yeah. It's It's one step above the National Enquirer. We lived in the New York Metroplex. The Post was not what we read. But it was also in the Mirror in the UK and Breaking Israel News. I got it on Breaking Israel News. Red Heifer, the countdown's begun. Unfortunately, unless I see it in the Wall Street Journal, on Fox, on CNN, on BBC, in 15 or 20 other news outlets, and I get that vibrating text on my phone, I'm sorry, it's a false alarm. It will be clear, and I've checked them all. Also, what's interesting here is in verse 15, we call it 15b, is a parenthetical remark by Matthew, very important. He says, and this is for the reader, from the writer. It's kind of like he steps out. What is that? Mr. Weber, was this what, suggestion box? This would be step out. I don't feel comfortable. No, I don't feel comfortable moving out that far. Over here, this is a sidebar. Matthew says, whoever reads this, let him understand. Do you know who he's talking to? You know who Matthew's talking to? That's right, you. He says you need to understand this and not be deceived. One day, it will happen. And it will happen with such fury and suddenness and abruptness, as we will read, and what we should be watching, it will shake us to the ground. When this tribulation happens, it will not be like any series of events ever in recorded history. Matthew says so through Jesus, or Jesus says through Matthew. There will be such great tribulation as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, nor shall there ever be. This is the big one. This will be the big one that will affect the entire world. What's interesting is this other specificity that Matthew brings up. He says, if you're in Judea about the mountains, let him, verse 17, who is on the housetop, not go down. Woe to those who are pregnant. I know one person in this building, at least one, there may be others that I don't know about. One person who's very, very pregnant, you can ask her, the last thing she wants to do is a 50-yard dash somewhere, right? So it has relevance, it has specificity. And those who are nursing babies, and we have a lot of small children here, and may God be thanked we do. It says to beware. That's what kind of time it's going to be. It's also interesting that the Sabbath is being kept. It's referenced. Now let's move to the answers to the two questions that asked. When will these things be, and what is the sign of your coming in the end of the age? Move with me to Matthew chapter 24, verse 29. Jesus picks up the thought here about the tribulation. Immediately, verse 29, after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then, read carefully, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds and from the one end of heaven to the other. He answers the question. He gives us, in this nexus of this entire section of chapter 24 and chapter 25, remember to Matthew, there's no chapter break, there's no verse break. It's one continuous narrative. But this, I think you would agree with me, is a nexus. This is a pivot point. He's giving you a sign. He's giving a sign. Brethren, when you have something bad happen to you, we have all gone through our bad times, you want one thing, whether it's sickness or relationships, whatever it is, you want it to end. You want it over. You want it to stop. Jesus tells them here the answer to one of their questions. What is the sign? This is the sign of my coming. When you see the Son of Man appear in heaven, and all the tribes of earth, they mourn. And they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds. And the trumpet sounds, and he gathers his elect from wherever they are, from one end to the other, wherever they may be. And we call that, in our parlance, a resurrection. And that is what this day pictures. It pictures the sign of the end of the age. It is the sign of the Son of Man. I thought, if you'll remember with me, I thought it was an evil and adulterous generation that seeks after a sign. Isn't this a sign? Aren't we seeking after it? This one seems to be allowable. This one seems to be so important. When asked, what is the sign? He tells them exactly and specifically. Because this is the sign where everything else pales in insignificance. And all the famines and the pestilences and the earthquakes and the wars and the desolation all come to a crashing halt when that Son of Man appears, and he ends it very quickly. When the heavens are rocked, this will be the sign of the Son of Man. I think it's so important when Jesus uses this word, and he really is the only one that uses it. It's the self-identification. It's code, the Son of Man. It references Revelation 1:7. He comes with the clouds. Mark 13, Luke 16. It also references back to them in those particular days to Daniel chapter 7, where the Son of Man appears to the Ancient of Days and accepts his kingdom. And that's Daniel 7. And he does so in the clouds. Acts 1:11, you can turn there if you would, I'll read it. Men of Galilee, the angels say, they said, why do you stand here looking into the sky? This same Jesus who has been taken from you into heaven will come back in the same way you have seen him go into heaven and in the clouds. This is the sign of this day, is the appearance of the Son of Man and the trumpet sound. Let's read it again. He will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. That means from no matter wherever they may be, God will find you. God will come looking for you. The trumpet blast is the signal, the end of the age as well. His elect are assembled to be with him, and that is that day. This, brethren, is a day. Technically, of trumpets. It is a day of the festival of trumpets. One day, there will be the day for the day of trumpets. It will be the singular day where God and Jesus Christ do not forget, and they fulfill the promise of promises, and they remember their people. We need to know what we look for and what we emphasize, the hope of an expectation, and when, as we heard in two prior messages, and in the special music, the change occurs. So we know what, but there's a but here. And it has to do, as all, when you say there's a but, it has to do with the when. We are not at that day. Jesus has more for us to know. In verse 36, he says, but of that day and hour, no one knows. Not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Let me read it again. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. This is really simple math. How many entities know the hour and the day of the end, the when? One person, when that was written. Maybe Jesus and the angels do now. The concept is so important, man forgets. We do not know when. We know what to look for. We just don't know when. It's so important, this concept. It's repeated over and over and over again in these sections. Jump with me to verse 42. He says to watch and be aware of the world around you. That's important. Watch, therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known that the hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Brethren, this is important. This is important, and it's not difficult. We have a very simple alarm system in our house. Here's the problem. It's got these cameras, and guess what I get? A notification on my phone. Yeah, here we go again. No phone. Your life's over. No notification, but I get a notification when one of the motion sensors has been tricked. Here's the problem. I find out when? After the fact. or at least maybe a little during. It's like a 12-second delay. Here's the problem. If you had a system that alerted you before the thief got there, now that's a system, right? How many would you sell? You'd sell millions. But no system exists. They can't anticipate when the thief is coming. There's no way to anticipate it. And Jesus is no thief. But the analogy is superb. We don't know. And I think we're not meant to. He repeats himself 5 times in 2 chapters. You don't know. I don't know. And when he wrote this, Matthew didn't know. The angels didn't know. And Jesus didn't know. That's good enough. So when somebody tells you they know, I'll give you a word of advice. Get away from that person. Get away. There's no end around. There's no work around for this section. You do not know, and that is the point. But Jesus says to not be afraid and to not be worried, to be confident, because he gives us a choice. He gives us a very simple choice he always has. It's just sometimes man chooses wrong. When the end occurs, we do not know. There's been plenty of people who said they did. They didn't. We're not meant to know. But we are told very clearly what sign we're to look for. We do not really seek it. We hope for it and pray for it and we expect it. We long for it. We want to see it not only for ourselves, but our loved ones and for the world. Our emphasis should be not on events we cannot control. I can't control what happens in Syria. It's secondary. I can't control what happens in the Sudan and the famine. I can't do anything about it. I can pray about it and pray that God's kingdom comes soon. Or is it better to look expectantly for a day when we will see that sign? That sign of signs that Jesus, known as the Son of Man, and a trumpet sound occurs. The choice befuddles mankind. It's just amazing. When God says, look for the Son of Man in the clouds, man says, it's going to happen now. I have my charts. Let me show you my charts. But your charts today don't look like the charts you had 5 years ago. Yeah, I know that, but I've made them better. I know you've never heard anybody like that. I know. I'm talking to myself. Our emphasis is wrong. Haven't we, in our normal human life, been told over and over, our prophetic methodology just doesn't work? I don't even know what the weather's going to be tomorrow, and neither does the weatherman, apparently. How can we predict specific events? I understand the need to be plugged in always, and to be, for the young people, to be fully woke. Didn't think I knew what that meant, did you? To be fully woke. Got to be woke. Google it. But we need to be aware of something else, someone else. We need to be aware, those of us who call ourselves believers, for watching for the king to return. There's an old adage at work about what to do when the boss is coming. The phrase I had where we worked was, the boss is in the building. Look busy. What did look busy mean? Busy doing what? What you're supposed to be doing. What you know to do. You do what you're supposed to do. And that's your job. The reason you are there. There is a continuation of the Olivet prophecy that rarely ever gets read. The setting is sure and the event very sobering. If you would turn with me as we read these last verses, I think God gives us, through Jesus Christ, the instructions of what we're to be doing while we wait and while we watch and while we are aware and while we look for that sign. Matthew 25, and we'll begin in verse 31. Notice the phrases that he uses, the setting. Verse 31, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations shall be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he will set the sheep on his right hand and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, you visited me. I was in prison, you came to me. This, brethren, is a part of the Olivet prophecy. It hasn't changed. The section goes on. I'll let you read it as you wish privately. God expects us to long for this day in its final fulfillment and the sign of the Son of Man in the end of the age. But we have a part to play. 2 Timothy tells us there is a crown of righteousness which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to us on that day. And not only us, but all who have loved his appearing. What are we to do while we wait, while we hope? I think Matthew 25, 31 through 36 is a great beginning to start. Have a wonderful day of trumpets.